I'd like to call to order the Joint K-12 Education Policy and Oversight Committee and the Healthcare and Human Service Policy and Oversight Committee joint hearing. Welcome to all of you today. This is kind of an exciting gathering. We're going to have some excellent speakers this morning with some pertinent information for the legislators and the general public. And we're also going to roll out some recommendations from the Childhood Obesity Working Group that's been meeting for some time through the summer and fall and winter. I think I would just like to lay out kind of the procedures for this morning. And that is, we're going to have our speakers come to the table, and I think there's enough chairs for them to come as a group. We will have the presentations one after another of our guest speakers. And then, and I would ask that they introduce themselves when they speak, read their name into the mic for the record, and then give your testimony, and then we'll move to the next speaker, and we will have all four of our groups speak, and then we will do Q&A from this body, from that group, that presentation. We will then change over and have the working group step forward. Representative Detmer and I, and Senator Bonhoff, if she arrives later, will go through the process of our working group and give our recommendations at that time, and then take Q&A after that as well. So I think without further ado, we should ask our speakers. We have Patricia Adams, Mark Manley, Hal Weschler, Julie Danzel, and Laura Titi. If you would come forward to the chairs. And Patricia Adams, I believe, is the Assistant Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health, and she's going to speak first on obesity in Minnesota and its effect on the health status of the state. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair and members of the legislature. I am Pat Adams, Assistant Commissioner from the Minnesota Department of Health. And first, I'd just like to say I bring your greetings from Dr. Sandy Magnan, our Commissioner of Health, who sends her regrets. She's out of town and unable to be here with you today. I'd also like to thank you for this opportunity to provide this statement for this hearing on obesity. I'd like to present you with the problem and how we are beginning to address it. Obesity in Minnesota and the nation is an epidemic. Nationally, the prevalence of obesity for adults has increased from 15% to 33% in the last 25 years. In 2006, 38% of Minnesota adults reported being overweight, and nearly 25% were obese. This represents a 250% increase in obesity since 1990. Prevalence of obesity over the last 30 years among children and adolescents in the United States has quadrupled for the children ages 6 through 11 years of age, and it has more than tripled for 12 to 19-year-olds. Obesity can have major consequences on the quality and the length of one's life. Being overweight or obese increases the risk of many health conditions, diseases, and premature deaths, including hypertension, high cholesterol, type 2 diabetes, gallbladder disease, depression, osteoarthritis, sleep apnea, and some cancers. Obesity doubles the risk of developing coronary heart disease, and it increases the risk of having a stroke by 1.5 to 2 times. In Minnesota, 33% of people have been told that they have high cholesterol, 22% have high blood pressure, and 6% have diabetes. 4 obesity-related conditions, namely heart disease, stroke, cancer, and diabetes, account for nearly 60% of deaths in Minnesota. The high costs of obesity and its related diseases are staggering, and you're going to be hearing more about that from Dr. Manley in just a few minutes. Last week, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported that the rates of obesity have shown signs of leveling off. And while this is good news, we are still in a crisis. Since a large percentage of us, both adults and youth, are overweight or obese, and we need to continue to take strong action to move the trend in the opposite direction. We cannot be satisfied with already unacceptably high rates of obesity and overweight that increase chronic disease, which then in turn drive up healthcare costs. How we found ourselves in this situation is quite clear. The rising rates of obesity are the result of a perfect storm of decreased physical activity and poor nutrition. 51% of us do not achieve the recommended amount of physical activity, and 81% consume less than 5 servings a day of fresh fruits and vegetables. The environments in which people live have a tremendous influence on the choices that we make about eating healthy and being physically active. Dramatic changes in the world over the past 30 years have altered our daily lifestyles. Advances in technology have engineered physical activity out of our daily life. And while media and advertising and easy access to large quantities of energy-dense food and beverages have promoted increased overconsumption, the physiology of our bodies has become out of balance in our daily school, work, and community environments, increasingly making it harder to make healthy choices. How we got here tells us how we solve the problem. While we have a responsibility to work with the public to educate ourselves about obesity and what we can do to prevent it in ourselves and our families, collectively, we also have a responsibility to do what we can to make the behavior changes possible. We know that there's little use in telling people to walk 30 minutes a day if they don't have safe routes to walk or if they don't feel safe in their neighborhoods. Children need to eat healthy food, but we are defeating ourselves if we provide unhealthy snacks and sugar-sweetened beverages in vending machines in schools. Employees may want to eat healthy snacks, but if the morning meeting includes only donuts, we will likely fail. We need to talk about eating more fruits and vegetables, but that will fall on deaf ears if they're not available within neighborhoods. By creating environments that positively influence the choices we have available, we are able to make the healthy choice the easier choice for Minnesotans, and we can do this. There are well-proven, evidence-based strategies we can and are implementing now. For many years, the Minnesota Department of Health has had physical activity and nutrition programs to educate the public about the importance of these two topics and to help build infrastructure for local public health departments. It is only within the last decade that obesity prevention has really become a key focus for us. And within the last 5 years, there's been a dedicated effort at MDH to combat this issue. In 2004, the department was awarded the Steps to a Healthier U.S. Cooperative Agreement from CDC to reduce the burden of chronic diseases in 4 communities in Minnesota. These communities began addressing the risk factors of physical inactivity and poor nutrition, among others, through policy, systems, and environmental changes. In 2008, the Minnesota Plan to Reduce Obesity and Obesity-Related Chronic Diseases gave voice to our long-standing efforts around physical activity and nutrition. The report offers solid, evidence-based solutions for the state, for counties, and communities to stem the epidemic of obesity. We were able to leverage that obesity plan to obtain a nutrition, physical activity, and obesity grant from CDC to move our efforts from planning to realization. All of the department's work to this point has really set the stage for where we are today. Last year, when you enacted the bold legislation addressing health care reform, you included in that the State Health Improvement Program called SHIP, and that has been launched. SHIP is part of Minnesota's health reform initiative, and it seeks to help Minnesotans to live healthier lives by preventing risk factors that lead to chronic diseases through policy, systems, and environmental changes. SHIP has compiled 35 interventions to reduce obesity through working with schools, businesses, healthcare, and the community. Every county and 8 tribal governments in Minnesota are now working to implement these SHIP interventions. Grants were awarded in July of 2009, and those communities are in various stages of implementing these changes. It's really important to mention that while SHIP is a statewide program that's being administered by the Department of Health, decision-making is local. Each local board of health and tribal government decides which interventions they will pursue in order to best address the unique needs and the interests of their community. So in conclusion, while much is being done in Minnesota to tackle the problem of obesity, much more needs to happen. We must also remember that the fix will not be fast. We did not get into this situation overnight, and we will not get out of it quickly. To achieve our goal of improving the health of all Minnesotans, we must continue to work to stop and reverse obesity trends through concentrated efforts supporting policy, systems, and environmental change, and the continued support for addressing health reform at the national, state, and local levels. Obesity reduction efforts are an important investment that will pay off through decreased health care costs and healthier lives for our residents. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I might just mention, and it may be touched on later, not everyone at the table has this, but there is a snapshot from Minnesota that was a publication put out by the CDC that highlights Minnesota and what we've done in the state that I think might be really interesting for legislators to get their hands on. So please get that before you leave today. And it looks like next up we have Dr. Mark Manley. Welcome, Dr. Manley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning. And thank you, members of the legislature. I'm Dr. Mark Manley. I'm the Vice President and Chief Prevention Officer at Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota. There I lead our work on prevention efforts, especially our work to reduce tobacco use and obesity among all Minnesotans. And prior to joining Blue Cross, I spent about 12 years working on prevention issues at the National Institutes of Health. Very briefly, I'd like to just confirm the alarming statistics we just heard from Assistant Commissioner Adams. Obesity is a major health issue, and we're at the crossroads of deciding whether we'll stand by and let this problem continue or create interventions that will make a difference. And I urge you to consider the many, many future cases of heart disease, diabetes, and cancer that can be prevented from taking a toll on Minnesota individuals and families if the right steps are taken now. Today, however, I'm going to focus my comments on the economic case for why it is also in the best interest of the state to address obesity. We're all paying the rising cost of health care, and over the last several years, obesity has been a major driver of these costs. It's estimated now that as a nation, we pay $147 billion a year in health care costs just to treat diseases caused by obesity. I'd like to present just a few statistics from a 2008 report that was commissioned by Blue Cross and the Minnesota Department of Health. It's called Obesity and Future Healthcare Costs, A Portrait of Two Minnesotas. It answers that question of what happens if we create interventions now or if we do nothing. So first, a little bit about the status quo. And here in Minnesota, more than 60% of Minnesotans are either overweight or obese. Healthcare costs for overweight individuals are about 12% higher than for people at a healthy weight, and for obese individuals, healthcare costs are 37% higher than for a normal weight individual on average. If current trends continue, by the year 2020, less than a quarter, 23% of Minnesotans will be at a healthy weight, and 31% will be obese. Our report also shows that 31% of the overall increase in health care costs from 2005 to 2020 will be due to weight increases. That is, a single risk factor, obesity, will drive nearly one-third of the increases in health care costs that we'll experience over that 15-year period. So this will result in $3.7 billion more in health care costs in 2020, again, if current obesity trends continue. We brought you copies of the executive summary of this report to share with you. I should note that these are conservative figures. They don't include other costs such as long-term care costs or lost productivity. These are just the health care costs. Right now, though, employee wellness is a huge driver of productivity and one of the main factors that determines an employer's overall health care costs. The logic of this is simple. Healthier employees are better able to perform their jobs and are less likely to develop the chronic conditions that require numerous and costly medical treatments. Today's children are tomorrow's workforce, and the healthier they are today, the less costly they'll be for employers. And the bad news, of course, is that obesity will continue to take its toll on these youth and drive costs up, perhaps even more than we've seen over the last several years. But the good news of all this is that this is largely preventable. We know from the crossroads that we face today that willpower alone won't solve this issue. But if we achieve even modest success at curbing the rising cost of obesity, we'll substantially decrease future costs and improve health. So, Madam Chair and members, to be serious about health care reform and containing health care costs, we really can't afford to ignore the human and economic toll that obesity takes on our quality of life and our health care system. I urge you to make solving obesity a priority today and earnestly consider the policy recommendations you'll hear this morning. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Manley, for the testimony today and also for your participation over the summer, fall, and winter in our committee work. Thank you.
Thank you.
And next we have Dr. Hal Weschler from the CDC. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. I'm Dr. Howell Wexler. I'm the Director of the Division of Adolescent and School Health at CDC's National Center for Chronic Disease Prevention and Health Promotion. Now, at CDC, we collect a whole lot of data, and I could recite statistic after statistic, but the two speakers have already laid out very dramatically the consequences of inaction on this issue. So I'm just going to share with you two numbers that I think tell a very big story, and then I'm going to spend most of my time talking about examples of innovative approaches to combat this epidemic that are being put in place across the nation in many, many different states. I was particularly delighted to have this opportunity to visit Minnesota because it gives me a chance to learn more about your statewide health improvement program. And I'm not sure you're aware of this, but public health professionals across the nation are looking on with great fascination and excitement. They consider SHIP to be one of the most promising and innovative approaches that's been launched to address the obesity epidemic. So we're very excited to see how that plays out. Now, while SHIP is very, very promising, I'm going to describe for you today some additional strategies for addressing obesity that Minnesota may want to consider. So here are my two numbers that I'm going to tell you before I get on to different policy approaches. The first one, 12.5 million. The second, 9.1%. 12.5 million obese children in the United States today. That has gone up by more than threefold since 1980. My focus will be largely on children. That's the area that I specialize in. 9.1%, that is the percent of the national total annual medical expenditures that is a result of obesity-related conditions. Just 10 years before that, it was only 6.5%. Clearly, the point Dr. Manley made, obesity is probably the greatest single driver of healthcare costs. And if you recognize that healthcare costs are a fundamental crisis and problem that this country has to address, then you know we will not get healthcare costs under control until we get obesity under control. How do we do that? Obviously, where does it come from? Physical inactivity and poor dietary choices. CDC has identified six critical behaviors that can be influenced to prevent or reduce childhood obesity. Three things we got to increase, three things we got to decrease. We've got to increase the consumption of fruits and vegetables. Obviously, we've got to increase physical activity. And here's one you may not be aware of. We have to increase the rates and length of breastfeeding. That has been shown to have a very strong protective effect against obesity. Three things we need to decrease: the amount of time our children spend watching television, their consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages, and their consumption of what we call energy-dense, low-nutritional-value food items. You may call them junk food. Far too many of our children and their families do not have healthy nutrition and physical activity as part of their daily lives. Now, many factors have contributed to unfavorable trends that have fueled the obesity epidemic. Consequently, multiple strategies are required to reverse the epidemic. If you're looking for that magic bullet, that one thing, it's not going to happen. This is too complex an issue. We have to peck away at the problem with multiple strategies. But the good news is we've learned a great deal about effective strategies for promoting physical activity and healthy eating among young people. And we know that what is most critical is to develop public policies that create and support environments that allow for regular and routine physical activity and access to healthful foods. Now, after conducting a very rigorous scientific review, CDC has identified 24 strategies that states and communities can implement to improve their physical activity and nutrition environments. Don't worry, I'm not going to cover all 24 of them. But I will cover a couple of them that I think stand out and are really being acted upon by states across the country. Most of these strategies fall into two broad categories: promoting the availability of affordable, healthful food and beverages, and encouraging physical activity. So I'm going to highlight some of the strategies that scientific evidence has shown to be effective and describe how other states are starting to implement them. And I'm going to focus my remarks on strategies related to three critical environments that shape the health of our young people: child care centers, schools, and the community settings in which children and their families live. Start with child care settings, which obviously can help children adopt healthy dietary and physical activity behaviors at a critical early stage in life. They can contribute to obesity prevention by serving only healthy meals and snacks, by making safe and palatable drinking water available, and providing high-quality nutrition education. They can provide daily physical activity, high-quality physical education, and they can limit the time that children spend watching television, videos, and computers. Now, a number of states and cities have adopted regulations that require child care centers to implement these types of practices. Robert Wood Johnson recently sponsored, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation recently sponsored an analysis that identified 20 model state child care regulations related to healthy eating and physical activity. And they graded states based on how many of these regulations they had in place. Minnesota earned a grade of C. Only 7 states had a lower grade. Here are some of the state child care regulations that are in place in other states, but not in Minnesota. Foods of low nutritional value are to be served infrequently. Sugar-sweetened beverages are not to be served. Nutrition education is to be offered to children. Children are to be provided with physical activity daily. Television, video, and computer time are to be limited, and physical activity education is to be offered to children. All those policies are in place in other states, but not Minnesota. Let's talk about schools. Schools can not only teach young people how to make healthy choices, but they're also a setting where young people do a whole lot of eating and where traditionally they've had plenty of opportunities to engage in physical activity. So obviously improving school policies and programs can have a major impact in obesity. I'm going to discuss 3 key strategies for schools. 1, establishing nutrition standards that determine which foods and beverages may be offered on school campuses. 2, providing students with a sufficient amount of high-quality physical education. And 3, adopting and implementing local school wellness policies. Now, there are meaningful federal regulations in place to ensure the nutritional quality of school meals, but there are no real meaningful federal regulations on the nutritional quality of those foods and beverages that are served outside of the meal programs, in vending machines, the a la carte lines, school stores, snack bars. And what we've seen, particularly in the 1980s and 1990s, was a huge growth in the number of schools that are selling high-fat, high-sugar, high-sodium, high-calorie snack items and beverages to our young people. A recent U.S. Department of Agriculture analysis of national data found among students who consume them, junk food and sugar-sweetened beverages bought at school account for, on average, 177 calories per day. That's 8% of their total daily energy intake from junk food bought at schools. And those empty calories add up. Over the course of a school year, that average student will have consumed 31,860 calories, the equivalent of 9 pounds in body fat in the form of junk food and sugary beverages at school. How states responded? Well, in 2004, only 6 states had adopted nutrition standards for schools. By 2009, that number had jumped to 27 states. The majority of states now have school nutrition standards. Minnesota does not have a school nutrition standards policy. And we've seen these state policies have played a critical role in reducing the number of schools in which students could purchase junk food and soda pop. A recent CDC study found that in a typical state now, nearly half of the secondary schools no longer sell junk food and soda pop to students. Nearly all states, including Minnesota, had made significant progress in recent years in decreasing the number of schools that sell junk food and soda pop. But some states made much more dramatic progress than others, and the range across states is huge. Nearly all the states that ranked highest in terms of not selling junk food and soda pop were those that had adopted state nutrition standards. Clearly, state policies have an important impact on the school nutrition environment. The range I told you about? Well, in Hawaii, 75% of the secondary schools no longer sell junk food or soda pop, while in Utah, only 13% don't sell junk food and soda pop. Across the states, the median figure, where half or above, half or below, is 46%. So half of the states, more than 46% of the schools, are not selling junk. Half the states, less than 46%. Minnesota was in the lower half. Only 38% of its secondary schools do not sell junk food and soda pop. There are other states, and I'll name two, which may surprise you. Mississippi and Tennessee. They went from the bottom of the rankings in 2006 up to the very top of the rankings in 2008 after they adopted state nutrition standards and implemented programs to help schools implement those standards. I used to go to those states and I used to say, your schools are a junk food heaven across the nation. Not anymore. They're making a difference. And I hate to say this when I visit the Midwest, but the Midwest for schools is now junk food heaven. Some have expressed concern that eliminating the sale of low-nutrient foods and beverages in schools will remove an important source of discretionary funding that schools use to pay for educational expenses. Well, on the one hand, this argument raises the ethical challenge of whether it's appropriate to pay for educational expenses through practices that are unhealthy for students. But on a more practical level, many schools have documented that immediately after they improve the nutritional quality of foods and beverages sold to students, yes, they typically experience a modest dip in revenues, but that is soon reversed, and revenues return pretty much to where they were before the changes were initiated. We see that in school after school across the nation. There is not much validity to these concerns about important financial losses from implementing good quality nutrition in schools. Now, next, I'd like to address high-quality physical education, which can increase students' level of physical activity, improve physical fitness, and motivate them to adopt and maintain a healthy lifestyle. There are two key strategies for ensuring that physical education does these things. One, increase the amount of time that students spend in physical education. And two, increase the amount of time that they spend being active in those physical education classes. Well, certainly finding enough time in the school day for physical education can be challenging, but a number of states have adopted policies in recent years to increase physical education requirements. Physical education requirements for elementary school students now meet the national recommendations of 150 minutes per week in 8 states. 34 states have specific physical education course requirements that high school students must complete to graduate. Minnesota is one of the 16 states without any physical education requirements for graduation. In recent years, the percentage of secondary schools that require physical education for students in Minnesota has declined, and it's lower than it is in most other states. Now, some communities have reduced time requirements for physical education in the mistaken belief that having children spend more time in the classroom and less time in the gymnasium will lead to improvements on standardized test scores. In fact, there is no evidence that increased time in physical education has a negative impact on academic achievement, and there are a considerable number of studies that show that participation in physical education and other physical activity programs actually has a positive impact on academic achievement. Schools can increase opportunities for physical activity without concerns about academic achievement. But a number of studies have documented that physical education classes typically do not provide enough time for students to be active during the class, unless the school is using an effective curriculum, which is taught by teachers with appropriate training. The first basic step in ensuring that schools are using an effective curriculum is the adoption of physical education standards, which identify in detail what students are expected to know and to do as a result of participating in physical education class. 47 states have taken that fundamental first step by adopting statewide physical education standards. Minnesota is one of the 3 states that has not adopted physical education standards. A third school-based strategy involves the local school wellness policies that federal law requires from each school district that participates in the National School Lunch Program. Evaluations have shown that nearly all school districts have adopted a wellness policy, but many are not being implemented effectively. Some states have supported strong local school wellness policies by requiring the policies to meet stated criteria, by directing local school districts to establish wellness councils with broad community participation, by requiring districts to post online their policies so that the community can be aware of what is expected, or by establishing mechanisms for state oversight of wellness policy implementation. I want to highlight for you one example from Connecticut. The State Department of Education there collects districts' wellness policies, and they grade the quality of the policies in relationship to a model policy they developed in collaboration with Yale University researchers. Each district receives a school wellness policy report, which they post online, and that documents the scores given to the district for its policies, as well as the scores obtained in neighboring school districts. And here's the kicker. The districts that adopt strong nutrition standards become eligible to receive additional reimbursement funding from the state for their school meal programs. So what's in those policies really matters. Finally, a couple of things about the community setting. Fundamental community strategies involve increasing access to fruits and vegetables and creating an infrastructure that supports physical activity. Farm-to-school salad bar programs, which deliver produce from local farms to schools, have been shown to increase fruit and vegetable consumption among students. Other mechanisms to allow consumers to purchase food directly from farms include farmers markets, community-sponsored agriculture, and pick-your-own programs. Minnesota is below the national average in terms of the number of farmers market per 100,000 population. 17 states now have some form of statewide farm-to-school program. Minnesota is not one of them. Another important strategy for increasing access to fruits and vegetables is improving the availability of food retailers in underserved areas. Supermarkets and full-service grocery stores have a much larger selection of fruits and vegetables at lower prices than smaller grocery stores, and research suggests that low-income, minority, and rural communities have fewer supermarkets, and that increasing the number of supermarkets available can increase access to healthy foods for economically disadvantaged populations. There are a number of different incentives that can be offered and are being offered in states across the nation to encourage the opening of new retail outlets in areas with limited shopping options. Things like tax benefits and discounts, loans, loan guarantees, supportive zoning, increasing the capacity of small businesses through technical assistance. 7 states so far have enacted policies that support access to healthier food retail, the most prominent one being Pennsylvania, which has provided $30 million in seed money that has then been leveraged with $90 million in private investment, and that has helped open, expand, or improve 74 grocery projects in almost half the counties in the state. Finally, in terms of promoting physical activity, community environments center around in creating safe communities that change the built environment. These strategies include improving access to recreation areas and parks, improving infrastructure to support bicycling and walking, locating schools closer to residential areas, zoning to allow mixed-use areas that combine residential with commercial and institutional uses, and improving personal and traffic safety in areas where persons are or could be physically active. I've shared with you information about some, but not all, of the 24 strategies that CDC recommends for preventing obesity. Obesity is clearly one of the greatest public health challenges of the 21st century. The outcome of our efforts to address this challenge will have major economic as well as health implications for our nation. Although the factors that have influenced the epidemic are multiple and complex, we have learned a great deal about effective strategies for preventing obesity. Our challenge now is to implement what we know, to put in place the policies, environments, and systems that allow for regular and routine physical activity and access for healthy foods. There's a lot that can be learned by actions taken by other states, and I would like to point out many of these actions have been taken, have been adopted very recently in the middle of the economic crisis. In fact, many of the strategies that I've talked about do not involve major fiscal implications and are either no or low cost, and that merits further consideration. They will take a long time. We're not going to turn the corner on this obesity epidemic anytime soon. This requires some patience concentration. Minnesota is off to an exceptional start with the statewide health improvement program. It builds a foundation, and there are a lot of other areas that can be considered as well. This is absolutely critical for our economic well-being, but most importantly, for the well-being of our children. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much for that testimony. And I think folks may be coming up to some questions. And I would say that many of the recommendations that we just heard are going to be part of what you're going to hear from the working group. And so when we break after the next speakers for questions and answers, ask the professionals rather than saving them for Representative Detmer and Senator Bonoff and I. So we're going to have one more presentation, and this is a local example. I think you'll find that eye-opening, and then prepare your questions, and we'll have all the professionals be available at that time. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Laura Teedy, and I am the manager of the Statewide Health Improvement Program at the Minneapolis Department of Health and Family Support. And with me today is Julie Danzel, who's the SHIP coordinator for the Minneapolis Public Schools. We are here today on behalf of the Local Public Health Association, an organization that represents city, county, and tribal health departments in the state. And we have been asked to tell you how the Statewide Health Improvement Program, or SHIP, is working in schools in Minneapolis. And I'm pleased to say that at least locally, we are implementing some of the strategies outlined by Dr. Weschler. As Assistant Commissioner Adams said earlier, the SHIP program is being implemented by city, county, and tribal public health departments across Minnesota. And in Minneapolis, our efforts to address childhood obesity span across multiple sectors. Through partnerships with PICA Head Start and Resources for Child Care, we are improving the food and nutrition practices of nearly every family-based and center-based child care program in Minneapolis. And through these efforts, we've seen the quality of food served to toddlers improve and their levels of physical activity increase. Through our Healthy Housing and Healthy Communities project, we're partnering with 10 low-income housing properties to increase residents' access to healthy foods and physical activity. And most notably, through our partnership with Minneapolis Public Schools, we have and continue to improve the nutrition and physical activity practices, policies, and environments in Minneapolis's largest school system. The Health Department and Minneapolis Public Schools have been partnering for over 5 years on a number of exciting health-related efforts that Julie will tell you about, and then I'll come back and tell you about some other school-related activities that we're doing.
Madam Chair, members of the legislature, I am Julie Danzel, Statewide Health Improvement Coordinator for the Minneapolis Public Schools, and I want to thank you again for the opportunity to share with you the important work that we're doing in Minneapolis Public Schools. I'd like to just begin with, why are schools doing this work? Why is this important? We've heard some important testimony this morning. I would like to add that first, we know that health impacts achievement. We know this both intuitively, and we know this from the research. I would add that secondly, that schools do contribute to a student's health and well-being. There's really no debating this. And finally, I would add that schools need partners. Educating the whole child takes the whole village. When Congress passed the Child Nutrition and WIC Reauthorization Act in 2004, it really was a historic step toward significantly improving the health and academic success of children across the nation. And this is the law that we heard earlier that mandates school districts all across the country to implement and adopt a wellness policy. So you might ask yourselves, do wellness policies really make a difference? And I can tell you the answer is yes. From 2007 to 2009 in Minneapolis Public Schools, we saw at least a 50% increase in the number of schools reporting healthy fundraising efforts, healthy classroom celebrations, and the integration of physical activity within the school day. Staff benefit, too, from these changes. We now have a wellness promotion in our weekly staff newsletter. We have annual school board updates on where we are as a district in terms of the wellness policy, and we've had numerous invitations for staff, wellness-related staff development. We also have had some significant institutional changes as well that include active wellness champions in each of our school buildings. We offer a three-part wellness series to those champions each year. We communicate monthly with them with internally developed and externally developed resources. And we have healthy vending choices that are fully implemented at 6 out of our 7 high schools. And yes, we continue to work with that 7th. In addition to these wellness policy-driven improvements, our Nutrition Services Department has taken many steps forward to improving the nutritional experience that students receive in our schools. All the fryers and a la carte have been removed from every school in our district, and the Pizza Hut is gone, and this was years ago. The efforts have really been concentrated on revamping the main fair, the main fair, and several new entrees have been introduced, which has resulted in a 3% increase in main fair sales, which may sound small, but I'm telling you that's a significant increase for nutrition services to see in their main fair sales. There's also been an increased focus on variety. Desserts have also been eliminated from the menu, and those funds have been specifically redirected to increase the amount of fruits and vegetables that are available, specifically fresh fruits and vegetables. So there's a fresh fruit bowl available at both breakfast and lunch that includes apples, bananas, pears, and they've also been able to increase more seasonal offerings as well. All the nutritional analysis information is available on the website for parents to see. Our parent payment system allows parents to track student purchases, which also provides opportunity for parents to have conversations with their students about healthy choices. And we've had a history of several years of offering a free universal breakfast to all students pre-K through 12. The purpose of our wellness policy is to develop healthy learners through a school environment that promotes and protects student health and well-being and ability to learn by supporting healthy eating and physical activity. And I think two of our most comprehensive interventions that emphasize this purpose are Safe Routes to School and Active Recess. Safe Routes to School is a movement to support and promote walking and biking to school. It was developed to encourage students to make healthy lifestyle choices, and it benefits individuals by reinforcing the importance of integrated daily physical activity. It also, as well as protecting the environment, practicing traffic and personal safety habits, as well as strengthening community relationships and neighborhood safety. And the work of Safe Routes to School in Minneapolis often occurs at the system level and is really the joint work of the city and the school district and involves the mayor's office, the city health department, the public works department, including internal departments at the district, transportation, safety and security, and student support services, and our facilities department, not to mention the numerous partnerships with parents, students, neighborhood organizations, and local businesses. And because of this collaborative approach and the demonstrated commitment of the partners, we can now say an interdisciplinary Safe Routes work group meets every other month with members from each of those agencies that I've mentioned. We've worked together to develop a standardized mapping process that will be used by both the district and the city when identifying suggested routes for students to take to and from school and getting around the neighborhood. We are tying our Safe Routes efforts into our safety efforts. We work closely with our emergency management department, and we've been able to share Safe Routes information at the safety information sessions. We know about two dozen schools are going to be getting bike racks this spring. In 2009, you might know, the first Wednesday of every October is International Bike and Walk to School Day, and 2009 was our most successful year yet. We had over 18 schools participate with 2,000 students that biked or walked to school that day, and it really took the coordination of all those partners for that day to be as successful as it was. And lastly, I would like to mention one of our newest projects under SHIP, which is called Active Recess. Recess gives kids a daily chance to be active. Okay. Active Recess is an organized approach that includes staff training, designated areas for playground games, clear and consistent student expectations that are going to result in an increased level of physical activity for those students on the playground. In Minneapolis, we're taking kind of a unique approach. We are going to promote active recess using the Positive Behavioral Interventions and Support System, otherwise known as PBIS. And PBIS is a district-supported initiative that has been underway for a few years. And it's a framework for creating and sustaining an effective school-wide behavior system. And one of the components of PBIS is what they would call playground management, what I would like to call active recess. So this intervention will incorporate active recess as a technique of implementing the playground management. And it also provides us the opportunity to collaborate with the PBIS team, link with their work, within our Department of Student Support Services, thus increasing both the sustainability and the reach of active recess. So by doing so, we expect to see both, as I mentioned, the increase in physical activity and a decrease in behavior incidents on the playground. I would like to thank you again for this opportunity to share with you the important work that we're doing to improve the health environment for students in Minneapolis Public Schools.
The work that Julie outlined began through a partnership between the schools and our local public health agency over 5 years ago, and it was made possible through the infrastructure that was provided through the Steps to a Healthier Minnesota grant and now SHIP. And based on that successful partnership between our two agencies and the tangible improvements that she just described to you, the Minneapolis Health Department is expanding its reach into the city's charter and alternative schools. And partnering with these institutions is increasingly important for three reasons. First, because at least in Minneapolis, enrollment in these institutions is growing quite rapidly. In fact, in the last three school years, it's tripled in Minneapolis. And second, a higher percentage of students attending charter and alternative schools are from groups with higher rates of obesity, that is, low-income and minority populations. And finally, these schools typically have fewer financial and personnel resources to dedicate to institutionalizing the types of policies and practices that Julie just outlined. So with SHIP, the Minneapolis Health Department intends to partner with at least 20 Minneapolis charter and alternative schools to help them enhance and implement their wellness policies. So between Minneapolis Public Schools and our work with the charter and alternatives, our efforts to address childhood obesity will touch nearly every school-aged child in the city. And it is our belief and our intention that this work, combined with our efforts outside of school settings, will, over time, ensure that children are and enter adulthood at a healthy weight. So thank you for your time and interest today.
Thank you very much. And before we move on to question and answer for the entire panel, so you can ask any of these folks questions, I just want to point out that part of the efforts in pulling this together today were with the help, the working group help, but Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, the Minnesota Cancer Society, the Minnesota Heart Association, and our Department of Health, which were some of the various stakeholders that were coming to our meetings this summer. So I wanted to thank them for bringing Dr. Weschler here and for his presentation. Having a nationally renowned speaker is very nice to have, and we appreciate your expertise, but we also have lots of really great local experts. And so now I think we should open it up, and if anyone has comments or questions about anything they heard, it looks like Representative Riley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for the Patricia Adams, I guess, the Department of Health. I just scanned it briefly, so maybe I missed it. I'm looking at the executive summary of the Department of Health, obesity, future health care costs. But I don't see any recommendations here. And were there any recommendations, and does the Pawlenty administration support the working group recommendations?
Okay. And the report was a joint report from Blue Cross and the Minnesota Department of Health, and it was a presentation of a scientific study. So this particular report was meant to present data only, and not a set of recommendations. So as we get into the discussion of recommendations, we can certainly talk through those. But that was not the purpose of that report.
Okay. Representative Graham?
Madam Chair, thank you. Then Ms. Adams, I would go back then to my question. Thank you for that clarification. That's why I don't see it on that summary. What is the position of the Pawlenty administration on the working group recommendations?
Madam Chair and Representative, I can't speak specifically to the Governor's Office perspectives on your recommendations. I can tell you that the Governor has been supportive of the SHIP initiative and what is happening locally in terms of working on the important issues of physical inactivity and nutrition, and that as part of the whole health care reform initiative legislation which he signed.
Okay. Madam Chair, one last question. Is there anyone here that could answer that question? And if not, I would ask that you get back to me and check and see. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Riley. It looks like Representative Detmer may want to address that. Or do you want to move on?
Address.
Okay, I have one other. Representative Bunn had a question first, and then we'll get to Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had two questions, one at the macro level and one close up. On the macro level, and this is probably for Mr. Welcher or the Assistant Commissioner, is you at the outset to provide information on nationally and in Minnesota on the levels of overweight and also obese adults and children. In order to put this in a global context of our healthcare cost discussions, do you have any data off the top of your head or with you about comparisons to other industrialized countries on these measures?
I can tell you we do have international leadership. There are some countries where the obesity rates are higher, but among most of the Western developed countries, we're right at the top. They're catching up with us, though, across the world, particularly in Europe, but we are near the top of the list.
Representative Vann, continue.
Now for a very specific question with regards to, I'm very supportive of the SHIP programs as part of our 2008 health care reform bill. I'm very glad we were able to maintain the funding last year amongst the cuts, and that it's being implemented across the state and all the counties. My question, given this has been left to the locals to decide what types of projects to pursue and fund, how much evaluation structure do we have in place for analysis of the effectiveness and the rates of return on these different kinds of projects? Because there's such a variety of things being done, I would hope in terms of guiding future investments in an area in public health policy generally that we have very good analysis of each of these projects and their relative effectiveness.
Madam Chair and Representative, I would like to assure you that we do have a rigorous evaluation that's in place, and it's a staged process for evaluation, beginning with more looking at the actual interventions that are happening. Over time, we'll be able to measure health behavior changes. That will take a little while, but we are expanding our behavioral factor, BFRSS, Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, as well as we will be continuing to use the Minnesota Student Survey as important tools for evaluating important indicators for success. We can get you more specific information on the evaluation if you'd like. I don't have that with me right now.
Thank you very much for that. And I might add that I've been asked to serve on our local county's executive committee for their SHIP grants. And not only are the interventions that are allowed research-based, so they can only choose interventions that are already proven, there's a rigorous evaluation for each and every one of those that an area chooses. And I was actually quite impressed with the rigor, so I think we'll have some really good information at the end. And they can get you the specifics of what's required. I don't have that on the tip of my tongue. Thank you for that. And I have Representative Detmer and then Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess this would be a question for Julie Danzel. I know, being an educator for 34 years, I saw a lot of changes in the school district where I taught. And also the three districts that I represent, I know they've taken some great steps in reducing the bottled soft drinks and so forth. I think now you will find mainly the water. Mm-hmm. In fact, the only place in the school district where I live, I think the only place you find sodas is in the teacher's lounge. But how has the bottling industry worked with you in the Minneapolis district in reducing this?
Madam Chair, legislator, I know that the our purchasing department has worked with our Coke had held the contract, and we do have only water now available in all of the schools. Our beverage contracts are handled at the central through our purchasing office, so all of our students have access to water only.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a question for the committee, just kind of a comment or two. First of all, I've had 35 years of training in dietetics since my wife is a dietitian. And
is there a degree with that, Representative Benson?
I'm not sure I've enjoyed every year of diet, but I've eaten well, and I do appreciate that. And she reminds me constantly of this issue of obesity and the effects, long-term effects and short-term effects it's going to have on the entire health bill, not only for the state of Minnesota, but for individuals in the country as a whole. Sugar diabetes, heart disease, all these other issues. And she reminds me that if we could get to this problem, especially with young people, it would make a dramatic difference in the long term. But I remember, having been a teacher as well, the day that my school district brought in junk food and sugar-based beverage dispensers, and my having an argument with the assistant principal in our building, who was so excited about this new revenue source. And then later on, about a month later, we would get memos from him complaining about the messy classrooms and hallways now littered with candy wrappers, other kinds of things, including the pop cans and so. And I walked up to him and I said, well, you know that you're responsible for this because you introduced all this into the building. You think so? He said. But we had a long debate last time about issues of mandates, putting mandates on schools. And we had a debate about the conflict of school instructional day and finding space for physical exercise and programs as well. And some of us were on a committee seeing what we could do to reduce the number of mandates that were unfunded on the schools. We had only a moderate success in that regard. I may have to change my mind, especially if I want to stay married, on this issue of mandating physical education for kids. But it is a real problem, I think, that we in the legislature and the governor's office need to seriously address, whether or not we can do the things that all of us know we have to do, and at the same time find the resources to implement it. So thank you, Madam Chair.
I appreciate that. And is there anyone that on the panel that would like to address the issue of mandates? Have you, Dr. Weschler, have you seen this happen in other states? You did mention that there's movement even during tough economic times in some states. Do you have a good example for us?
Well, I mentioned, for instance, the states of Mississippi and Tennessee. There's a very, very strong sentiment in their legislatures and among their policymakers against mandates. And you know, most every state feels that they're, when it comes to education, they're a strong local control state, and then they go off and they pass all sorts of mandates on issues that they care about. And what it really boils down to is just how much do you care about the specific issues at hand. And, you know, it's hard. You have to think of the parents who are trying to do the right things. You know, we don't want to infringe on people's rights, the local community's prerogatives, but what about the parent who's trying to raise their kid in the right way, who's trying to teach them about what is appropriate to eat and how you shouldn't be sticking your candy and cookies into your mouth before your lunch and things that they would never be allowed to get away with at home, but you open up the floodgates when that's the case in schools. So there are some issues that apparently some policymakers across the nation who typically have felt strongly about not imposing mandates on local communities and local school districts, but they have come to feel that these issues are so important they have to act.
Thank you for that. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Weschler, first of all, thank you for coming today, and you presented some very interesting material, and it went by very, very fast. I know you covered an awful lot, but I just wanted to ask you to kind of give us the condensed version for a second, and, you know, talk for a second about which of the strategies have been shown to have the quickest payoff in reducing obesity and saving money. Maybe a little bit about how those things have been measured. But, you know, if we wanted to have the biggest return on an investment, assuming we would be able to make one, either in policy or a fiscal investment, where would we turn?
I don't think any of the strategies really have a quick turnaround. I think that's important to recognize, that it took us decades to get into this mess. It's going to take a while to get out of it. I don't know that we have the data available to give you really sophisticated answers to that question. Some of the things that have been the most impressive have been getting the junk food out of schools. The supermarket initiative is tremendously promising. There's very strong data that if people don't, it's common sense, if people don't have access, if there are no locations in their communities where they can obtain fresh fruits and vegetables, it's just not going to happen. They've been able to attract, with a little bit of state resources in Pennsylvania, for instance, they've been able to attract major private sector investment as well. So they're just some tweaks of the systems in addition to those kinds of incentives have enabled communities that have been what we call food deserts, places that even if you wanted to eat well, you simply couldn't. The choices weren't there. That, you know, that cries out, perhaps, because that's the most obvious injustice, the most obvious hurdle to overcome. We don't really have the information yet to give you, though, a sophisticated answer on where you get the biggest bang for the buck.
Thank you for that. Representative Peterson and then Representative Loom.
Thank you, and I certainly agree with everything that has been said here today and all the recommendations, but I think one might be missing. We listened, the McKnight Foundation sponsored a three-day seminar, and one of the speakers was from the CDC, who has done research on early childhood, the birth through 5 years, and his research talks about the environments, both the child care, whether it's family, friend, and neighbors, or child care centers, or the family. Then if a child has 5 or 6 risk factors, especially a toxic environment, that they're 4 times more likely to not only have obesity, but heart attacks and all of the kinds of major health problems that we deal with in the public health arena. So I'm wondering if you're aware of that and the return on that, not only for learning, as what they say, you're saving society and public health 17-1. It seems to me that that's a huge area that we need to address. And it's not the only one, but that those early learning years, 0-5, the research at Harvard and the University of Minnesota and now the CDC really kind of come together and say that the investment there in seeing that we not only have quality child care, but that we have good early learning environments are probably the most important thing that we can spend our money on. And in the long term, make a big dent in the public health problems of obesity. So I'm wondering if you have had any, if you've talked about with your colleague about that research or have any comments on it.
Absolutely, and child care settings was one of the settings that I did highlight. There was some very exciting work being done in cities and states across the nation to improve the regulatory environment. A lot of people who are in child care settings, people tend to do things in the way they've been doing it. And sometimes they need a little push, a little framework to be put in place to get them in the right direction. Obviously, we want to have family education programs to improve the home environment. Those tend to be more challenging, more costly, more labor-intensive. So they're certainly on our list, but for the reasons that they can be fiscally challenging, maybe not near the top. But the child care setting is absolutely critical environment to intervene, and it would be a lot of bang for the buck there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the only reason I questioned was because you mentioned mostly the dietary things and the child care, and you said child care centers. And we have we only have about 30% of our students in child care centers. Most of them are in home or other kinds of settings, even school settings. And it's not just the fruits and vegetables and the dietary. It's also all of those other things like the chemical abuse, the physical abuse, emotional abuse, poverty, all of those things that play into all of the aspects. It's a very complex issue when we talk about the public health arena, what we can do, I think, and particularly obesity.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much for that. And I will say on the working group, we did have Representative Slawik sit in one afternoon. She was able to come one day. They aren't in our recommendations, and I actually questioned that at the end, but we just didn't have enough really one-on-one dialogue, and I think you'll see Representative Slawik in her committee address some of these very concerns because she is very interested in it, and I wish we'd had a little bit more time to delve into that because I think it's very, very important.
It was very compelling
discussion
by the CDC.
Thank you, and I'm glad you brought it up. Representative Loon, followed by Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd like to thank the panelists. I think this is an incredibly important discussion and something that I personally have a great deal of interest in. And I'm just going to harken back to my experience when my kids were a bit younger. I was president of one of our local elementary schools' PTO organizations. And I remember strongly one of our first meetings in the fall of the year and when we incorporated all-day kindergarten into our elementary buildings. And the number of kindergarten parents that came to sort of a coffee meeting, get to know your PTO representatives, complaints about the school lunch program. This was their first exposure to it. And I don't know if Ms. Denzel or any of the other panelists could talk about school lunch and are we seeing improvements and what the barriers are. I mean, are there, what are the restrictions with regards to our school lunch programs in terms of whether it's ingredients or food sources that they're getting through federal nutrition programs, sourcing problems? Because some of the wellness things that you mentioned, I know, have been incorporated into our own school district as well. But we also got complaints from parents saying, okay, I can't bring cupcakes to the Valentine's party because that's against our wellness policies, but you're feeding my kids chips and salsa for lunch on Nacho Supreme Day, and my child won't eat the meat, and they won't eat the cheese sauce, so that's what they're having for lunch. And, you know, I've got to say they made a good point. And so how far have we come and where do we need to go on school lunch?
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I can speak from a Minneapolis perspective, and I know that some of the constraints when planning school meals includes preparing lunch for about 33,000 children each day. So there is sort of those quantity barriers, but I think that when I've worked with our nutrition services folks, they have for the reimbursable meals $1.02, and I hope I'm quoting that number right. I know it's just over a dollar. I believe it's $1.02 to pull that meal together. And so when they took some bold steps of eliminating the a la carte, which was a very, which was a revenue stream for them, it was a risk, but they knew that it was the right thing to do. And so they've been able to do some modifications, such as I had mentioned, removing desserts from the menu and redirecting those funds directly to fruits and vegetables. With some of the modifications they've done, I know when they were phasing out a la carte, some of the things that nutrition services departments might use is price structuring. So I think when our wellness policy first was adopted, you could buy a cookie for 25 cents. Well, the next year it was a dollar, and then the year after that it was gone. And so there was some price structuring things that they put into place to decent purchasing some more of the unhealthy choices in a way then, and then they were eventually faded out. But again, sort of recapping, I think the dollar to pull the price, the financial constrictions, and I think are probably some of the biggest barriers, but then using the opportunities that you have to sort of reprioritize how you're going to put that meal together.
I'd like to propose another barrier that's critically important. Think about the job that a school district food service manager has to do. Think about how hard it is for us to feed, we have two or three kids in the house, how hard it is to feed them nutritious food that they'll actually like and eat. But they've got to deal with 2,000, 3,000, 36,000, tremendous challenge. They've got to comply with all the food safety regulations. They have to hire the staff. They have to bring in revenue. I can go on and on with the responsibilities they have. We collect data on a national basis. About half of the school districts in the country, their child nutrition managers have nothing more than a high school diploma. Okay, we are asking them to do this most incredibly sophisticated, challenging job, and we're not hiring people who have the certification or the skills or experience, probably because we don't want to pay them what we'd have to pay them if we hired people with more skills. So there's a mismatch there. That's not there's no short-term fix for that, but when you list out the fundamental challenges, that's certainly one of them. What we have seen across the country, I can tell you that there still aren't plenty of schools where parents and students have a lot of frustration. We have seen over the past two decades tremendous growth in the number of model school programs. So even with all the barriers, when you have the right people in place, they do miracles, and tremendous things happen. And there are many, many school food service programs where the staff, the parents, and the students are very happy and enjoying and consuming that nutritious food. We've just got to make it easier so that more and more school districts can be like that.
Thank you very much. And if I could ask a follow-up question, you mentioned early on that school nutrition standards policies were one of your recommendations. Is there some state that you would say is has a best practice or that we might look at?
Yeah, well, there's first of all, we sponsored a report by the Institute of Medicine. The prestigious Institute of Medicine came out with a report in 2007, and they had the best scientists in the country, the most rigorous process, and they identified their model nutrition standards for schools. So that's really the place to start. West Virginia has been the state that's been closest to adopting measures like them. California, Hawaii, Rhode Island has very strong standards. Mississippi has adopted some of the strongest standards in the country. And Connecticut, again, I mentioned that earlier, they have a wonderful system where not only do they have standards in place, but they actually give an extra dime, 10 cents, for every reimbursable school lunch if you prove that you are meeting their standards for not only school meals but the entire school nutrition environment. So they have backed it up, and that's doing wonders to improve nutritional quality in the state of Connecticut.
And I really appreciate that last suggestion. I think in our working group this summer we talked about similar using a carrot for districts who will do the right thing. We talked about that with regard to physical education as well, and again it's a funding issue, but it did come up in our discussion. Representative Mahoney, you had a question.
Well, I thank you, Madam Chair, and I like Representative Benson have someone who is orientated towards food, and to the point I had to tear a flower garden out to put an herb garden in. Excuse me?
Those are pretty too.
I'm sitting here looking at these numbers, and I will compliment Governor Plenty because my understanding has been very supportive of SHIP and what they've done and continues to support it, and I think it's really important that we try to get a statewide health improvement program put together and funded and continued. But I look at, you know, I keep a messy desk, but I look at this and 2003, or in the 70s, we ate about 2,200 calories per day, and our fat and oils have risen by 63%, and our sweetener consumption has increased to 79 pounds, or up 400%. If a morbidly obese person loses 8 to 10 years off their life, by this chart, the state's going to have to spend $3 billion a year more in health care costs. So if anyone's from the state here, from the department, or from the governor's office, the governor imposed a cigarette tax on cigarettes when it costs $1 billion a year. And I mean, so has that been talked about? Has the governor talked about it? Has the department talked about it? Has the U.S. Congress talked about imposing some kind of a sin tax on some of these foods? Because it certainly seems like that's what you did with cigarettes. That's when we started killing people with cancer. And the numbers are the same. And the more chronic medical problems, I mean, aside from a couple things here, the exact same things that they said about cigarettes. So, any answers?
Madam Chair and Representative, we are preparing a report to the legislature on the state health improvement program, and one of the mandates in that report is that we bring to you some recommendations for future funding. Obviously, in these times, those are just going to be very difficult choices, but there are a whole array of options to look at, syntax as being one of those. So I guess stay tuned. I think there's going to be a healthy debate about those options.
Representative Mahoney.
Yeah. Two things here. Is that going to come before Governor Plain leaves or after Governor Plain leaves? And then, Representative Bunn, you talked about having really good analysis. We should all remember, as we look to cut $1 billion or $5 billion, every time we ask for analysis of a problem, we are asking our state employees to work longer hours for less benefits and generally less respect, unfortunately. So every time we ask, we're costing labor hours and time and energy from our state employees. So we need to be careful when we ask for analysis. But Are those recommendations coming this legislative session or next legislative session?
We anticipate you should be seeing them shortly.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I think, Representative Mahoney, it might be worth noting that when we do ask for an analysis, I think then it is incumbent upon us to actually look at the recommendations and do something about it. And I think we fall short sometimes as a legislature by having reports and having them sit on a desk. And so I'm hoping that we're going to have some recommendations that we can actually move ahead with some legislation. And unless anyone has further questions, maybe it's time to shift into the next portion, which is just the recommendations of the work group. Did anybody else have anything they want to ask before we move on? Okay, I think then we're going to move on. And Representative Mariani, are you going to be here?
Sure.
Okay, I will hand over the gavel to Representative Mariani. Thank you very much, all of you, for your presentation. We really appreciate the information. Representative Detmer and Senator Bonner.
And members and folks in the audience, there is a handout summary recommendations. I suspect that our colleagues will be referring to that, so you might want to pull that out and be ready to walk through that. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's interesting to see the group from this perspective now. On behalf of Representative Detmer, Senator Bonoff, and the number of senators and representatives that were members of the Childhood Obesity Working Group, we want to thank you for the opportunity to present the recommendations at this special hearing. I appreciate the willingness of Representative Mariani and Representative Thiessen to hold this hearing. I know it's very unusual when you have the House Health and Human Service Committee and the K-12 Policy Committee come together. And in fact, some of the staff said, why are we doing this? What's the relevance on obesity with schools? And hopefully that's become obvious as we've moved along. And I think your recommendations, the recommendations we have, you'll see will cross both of those committees and actually several other committees as well. So I also want to thank the testifiers today for raising the awareness level and providing some really, really good data and information for us. We have wonderful local professionals, and it was super to have Dr. Wechsler here from the CDC. We really appreciate his making a special trip here to Minnesota. Before we look at the recommendations and potential solutions here in Minnesota, I want to give you a brief background of the working group and its genesis. The working group is bipartisan and bicameral, as you can see from my right and my left. It was a combination of legislators, and I want to say department people, and I think, Representative Greiling, you really have been impressed with the folks that we had in the room. We had representatives from the governor's office there on occasion. We had the Department of Health and Human Services, the Department of Education, and many, many stakeholders also to the table. So that was very exciting to have that many people with this interest level of interest in this issue. And they were also, the legislators that came were also people that had worked on various legislations in the past session, some of which had passed, like SHIP, and some of which did not, like the physical education and some of the other pieces of legislation. And so they came to the table to get updated and see if there's something we could do in a different way this session moving ahead. With fiscal constraints on the state and the school system, these legislators felt that an informal working group should come together during the interim and review the data and best practices and come up with some innovative recommendations that would help keep kids more active and healthier in the school and home environments. But first, after receiving some thorough presentations, many of them actually, and reviewing some exhaustive studies and reports, the working group felt it was important to affirm some conclusions that have not been given adequate attention during our policy debates up here at the Capitol. So, in order to reduce childhood obesity, the working group believes multiple strategies are needed to be utilized, including but not limited to physical and nutritional education, physical activities in schools, communities, outdoor-based, and extracurricular activities, quality nutrition in schools, grocery stores, restaurants, farming, youth facilities, including daycare and home, and a lifelong commitment to health and wellness. The working group also affirms support for physical and nutritional education and physical activity as key to increase student academic performance, lifelong physical activity skills, and quality nutrition choices. The reduction of early onset diabetes and heart disease, which would ultimately lead to the reduction of increased health care costs. And we had some really good data today supporting that. When it came to creating recommendations, the working group chose to abide by a number of guidelines. And I think once you hear these, you will understand the recommendations a little bit more. The guidelines that fit with the reality of the 2010 legislative session were what we came up with. While members did not want, did want to go further in the recommendations, and I can assure you, those of us here and some of you at the table that attended those would very much like to go further, we did want to be sensitive to the times that we're in. So the recommendations, we decided, should be evidence-based, generally related to legislation, contain no fiscal impact unless it created savings or new dollar opportunities, and be free of mandates. So you will, you might see similar topics, but perhaps a different approach to those topics in our recommendations. We also felt that the recommendations could be made that encourage action by other legislative committees, and we have today here K-12 policy and health and human service policy, but members of other committees, such as environment, came to our meetings and had an input, and you'll see some of those recommendations that came out of their involvement as well.
Representative Norton, I'm just going to interrupt very quickly. Can you, for the committee, tell us what evidence-based means, and as opposed to research-based, or just so that we're all speaking the same language here?
Well, I think often research-based and evidence-based are used interchangeably. We use data from from research studies that were valid and reliable and peer-reviewed. We had information from the CDC, from state reports, from national publications. So we, rather than it being anecdotal, we tried making certain we had information that had plenty of hardcore data to support it, and our departments of health and the CDC information, and certainly the information from Blue Cross Blue Shield and other support groups provided us with that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So first, the recommendations on physical education. Adopt statewide physical education standards based on current national standards or state-level guidelines. This would significantly reduce the cost, if any, to the state and local school districts and would qualify school districts to apply for federal physical education grant funds, which currently they're not able to apply for. Until we have statewide PE standards, our schools will continue to lose millions of dollars each year in federal funds. One of the other recommendations relates to SHIP, and having talked with our Department of Public Health, it is possible in some of the discussion we've had that it's difficult for the state and schools to say it's free to develop standards or implement standards. It is possible to use SHIP funds in this manner, so we may already have a funding source available, so that may help us get past some of the past resistance in this area, and we're very pleased about that. We also ask that the Department of Education collect annual data from school districts on number of PE classes, whether they're implementing the PE standards or not, and if they require PE classes in high school for graduation. One of the issues we've had in the past is we haven't had the data when we've asked for it, and I can tell you I'm sure someone will ask the question, the department was in the room and was there when we reviewed these recommendations, and we didn't hear any resistance to that at this point, so the discussion and dialogue is still open in their interest in doing this.
So, hello. I think I know everybody here, but I'm Senator Terry Bonoff.
Bonoff, welcome. It's good to have you here.
Yes, thank you, Representative Mariani. So I'm here just to support the work of the working group and let you know that it really was a bicameral exercise. And so I wanted to make sure and join you here today so that you knew that we in the Senate feel equally as strongly about the recommendations that we put forward. And so I asked to present this one because I felt particularly strong about this particular recommendation. So this recommendation is around physical activity, that we believe 60 minutes a day of physical activity should be encouraged. But how that is done, we do leave up to the schools and suggest that physical education teachers are used as a resource to help integrate physical activity into non-physical education classes, recesses, extracurricular activities throughout the school day. this particular issue is what had me be interested in co-chairing this group in the first place. Last year during the session, there was a bill that mandated an additional credit be done in high school. And I felt like that was really putting a Band-Aid on what we all know is so important, and that is that all of our kids be active all of the time. And so, you know, I had just read the book Spark, and I kept talking about it in the subcommittee, but I still feel very strongly that we now have evidence that if you raise the aerobic heart rate for a certain period of time, that you actually stimulate the brain, and you will produce, you know, higher academic results. And so I think anything we can do without mandating, but sending a strong signal to our school community that we're asking them to creatively have every student active 60 minutes daily. You know, we can't make them, but, you know, I'd love to do contests, incentives, anything that could be done that we are promoting that. And I particularly have appreciated the NFL campaign. Those of you who have been watching the playoff games and see the NFL is actually sponsoring an NFL Play 60 campaign. And I think we're all on the same page. And even the fact that we have our First Lady now saying that childhood obesity is a priority of hers underscores that I think the time has come to take this on. So thank you.
Thank you.
We'll keep moving along and save up your questions. We also recommend to the Environment National Resource Committee to encourage the incorporation of physical activity and outdoor education when funding environment and natural resource services and programs. And as I mentioned, some of the members of these committees were there and will take this forward in some manner. On the issue of recess, which Senator Bonhoeff just mentioned, there was concern about it being taken away from students as a form of punishment, but not outright prohibiting this practice. And perhaps when we're done here, Representative Detmer might talk about, as a former teacher, usefulness on occasion of that strategy. But we do think, as in order to get the 60 minutes in, we need kids out at recess. And I think the suggestion that was made earlier about active recess makes a whole lot of sense. So consensus was reached by discouraging the punishment and instead promoting quality recess guidelines that engage all students, increase activity levels, build social skills, and decrease behavioral issues. We also thought, and as I mentioned this earlier, that if funds for SHIP, the Statewide Health Improvement Plan, could be used for quality physical activities during recess, this would create a disincentive for it being a discipline tool. In the area of transportation, the working group recommends authorization for the complete streets policy proposal. Again, this probably will come through a different committee than yours, but you should just know it's out there. This sanctions a planning process that allows for future roadways to include safer routes for children walking and biking to and from school. And actually, complete streets is actually more community-based. It's not just about school. It's about all of us being able to get out and use bikes and be pedestrians safely in our own communities. And I can say I believe Rochester is the first. I don't think they're the only anymore city that's already adopted complete streets, and it hasn't been cost prohibitive. It did take a while to get it going, but I think we can be a good role model for the rest of the state as we move forward in trying to increase physical activity. Then we discussed nutrition in schools. We were encouraged by farm-to-school programs. We've heard about that a few moments ago, but felt that the Agriculture and Education Committees need to further review and support the benefits, a way that better coordinate these programs to make them more affordable in school districts. There have been some barriers that have come up with regard to can we afford to do this, and there are pilot programs out there, many of which are through SHIP, and I think we can learn from that and perhaps move forward in the future, but for now, we support a legislative resolution to declare a farm-to-school week in September later this year, and I know our actually cafeteria up here has done some local produce initiatives in the past year or two. I don't remember if we had them last year, but the year before, and hopefully that could be part of this farm-to-school week. To incentivize more nutritious behavior, members of the working group also want to see SHIP funds to use for education and systemic collaboration that improves food and beverage options and that supports the farm-to-school program. Finally, we had two miscellaneous points. One recommends that school districts, where available, post their wellness policies on websites that parents and community can access. And the second recommendation adds support for the current SHIP program and funding for it. And I just want to say that, again, many of us would like to spend a little bit more money to ensure that this continues in the future, but it didn't meet with our guidelines this year. So what this group strongly felt was to make a statement of maintaining SHIP funding, making certain that it is not attacked during what's going to be a very contentious budget discussion that we have this year, I'm sure. It's just the SHIP program's just begun to local collaborative projects in all these communities. We need to continue to let them move forward, and I think we're going to get the information and more data to move forward throughout our whole state and improve the health of all of our citizens. So I just want to say, I want to acknowledge the time and effort that all the members put in. We had crowds at all of our hearings, great participation from departments. It was really a pleasure to work. We shared the gavel, Senator Bonhoff and Representative Detmer and I, we shared the gavel at the various meetings. It really was a pleasure to work bipartisanly and to have such great input from not only stakeholders but the departments, and to come to consensus on a large number. They may not be, we aren't spending money, so they may not be as aggressive as everyone wants, but I think it's a very positive step in the right direction. And so Representative Detmer's going to say a few words, and then Senator Bonhoff may want to say a few words, and then we take questions.
Representative Detmer.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Norton. And it was a real pleasure to be working on this committee. I guess I could go back to 2007 when I first came into the legislature that I authored and co-authored the fiscal education bill for our schools. That has been my focus. Even within the committee hearings that we've had, my focus has been on physical education. Of course, the committee has been a lot more broader in the other areas that you heard today. But being an educator for 34 years and being a physical education teacher and an outdoor education teacher, I'm also a master fitness trainer in the military that I serve. I really see a real need that we need to look at what we're doing in our schools and continue on with some of the things that we're suggesting here out of the committee. And I think it's important to emphasize several points. We have been stated during the working groups that we've had in the last over the summer. First, physical education is a necessity in our schools and is much more than just physical activity. I know we need to teach students how to develop their own fitness programs, and that will carry on through their lifetime. The best situation for schools is that these classes utilize state quality teaching network benchmarks that are based on national standards, and incorporating physical activity throughout the day, whether it's in classes, recess, before or after school. Second point, I want everyone to take any negative memories that you might have or any negative memories that your children might have about physical education and erase them from your mind. That needs to be done right away, I think. Today's national standards or state benchmarks are meant to be positive skill-building experience for students. Briefly, there are six. Value physical education for health, enjoyment, challenge, self-expression, and social interaction. I was speaking to the good doctor here, and we're about the same age. Maybe I'm a little bit older, but you don't have to be middle age before you start thinking about your personal fitness and health. And these things that if they're learned at an early age, and how to take care of yourself and how to develop your own fitness programs, will lead you throughout your whole lifetime. Exhibit responsible personal social behavior and respect for self and others in physical activity settings. Achieve and maintain a health-enhancing level of physical fitness. Regarding type of work that you do, I know in the legislature we're sitting on our behinds a lot, and if you think about being a student in school, what are they doing mostly? Sitting down and listening and so forth. We need to take a look at how to maintain our health and a level of physical fitness. Participates in regular physical activity. Demonstrate understanding of movement concepts and principles and strategies and tactics that are applied to learning and performing of physical activities. It's more than just being out and exercising. Demonstrate competency in motor skills and movement patterns and need to perform a various of physical activities. Now, a third point that I would like to add. Increasing physical activity has strong correlations with improvements in academic performance, attendance, and reduction of disruptive behavior. Adding daily physical activity improves academic achievement without taking away from academic performance. Research facts have shown that a student's health is a significant factor in their academic performance. Two, Providing physical activity, healthy food choices, and good wellness role models at our school improves student overall health and academic performance. 3. Daily physical activity has been shown to lead to lower discipline issues. 4. Physical activity triggers chemical changes in the brain that promotes learning, as the senator pointed out. 5. School-based physical activities programs increase concentration, improvement in math, reading, writing scores, and reduce disruptive behavior. The last one, students who participate in exercise regularly are less depressed, use drugs less frequently, have higher attendance levels in schools and higher grade point averages than students who do not engage in regular physical activity. So it's no longer about dodgeball. No, I like dodgeball. It's, you know, you can get a good workout in dodgeball. But if you can hit a home run, or how many touchdowns you can score, or you know, that's not what it's about.
I could never throw a ball.
It's about promoting physical activity, enjoying it, understanding it, and how it works for you, not against other people. My final point is one that Representative Norton made, but it bears repeating. Minnesota is missing out on millions of dollars, federal physical education program grant dollars, each year, as we are only one of three states in the country that don't have statewide PE standards, physical education standards. By passing legislation that allows school districts to follow the national standards or the state quality teaching network benchmarks, we are lowering another barrier for our schools and for our kids. And again, thank you again for this opportunity to present these recommendations. And I encourage every member of these committees to support the recommendations that will be part of legislation this coming session. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. Increasing academic outcomes and decreasing future health care costs, it sounds like a win-win for all of us. I do have, and thank you, each of you, Representative Norton, Senator Bonoff, Representative Detmer, for your leadership throughout this interim on this issue, and also for putting together a very concise, clear, and powerful document for us to work off of. I do have three members who have questions. Let me just throw one out very quickly. First of all, Dr. Westler, I believe is how you pronounce his name, had mentioned that Minnesota is one of the few states that does not have a school nutrition standards policy. So I don't see that in this recommendation. Can you just maybe say something briefly about that?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. If only we'd had them at our committee this summer, it would have been on the list, I'm quite sure. I think we will probably take that under consideration. We do have to, of course, make sure it doesn't affect the budget in some negative way, but I do think, again, SHIP grants could probably be used to help in some of the development of policy, so perhaps this could be, again, implemented at a low cost or no cost to the state, and I think we'll probably have that discussion, and you may see some language move forward.
Well, and I do get that these pieces are all meant to really work with one another as opposed to just, you know, a magic bullet solutions to this issue. We have questions for Representative Abler, Faust, Liebling, and Dietrich. Representative Abler.
Thank you, and just to your point, I had a bill about that, and there's quite a bit of pushback on that, so good luck. I have six boys, and we encourage them, I wouldn't think of the word nagging, to eat good food, and they're active anyway, and just yesterday one of my sons said, can we get some real food in our house? We have little grain things, and anyway, I thought it was pretty good over eating, but anyway, I have a question for you about there's a question coming. On these standards, and I supported the mandatory standard. Just so you know where that's coming from, but I have a question about the mandatory half credit thing, but the standard in lieu of a credit requirement. Do you think, this is conceptual, I know, but conceptually, do you see that a district would be required to have, if they have FIAD, they have to adopt that standard? Or if they wanted to get money, they could adopt the standard we would adopt?
Mm-hmm. I suspect we'll have some opportunity during session to get deeper, so maybe just a quick sense.
Yeah, just quick is good.
Well, I think just to say the bills have not yet been written, but part of our discussion at the committee level was We want to allow states to access the federal money if they can. We want to move forward toward getting those standards. But at this point, we were trying very hard not to have mandates. So there may be a way for a district to choose not to do that, but then, you know, they need to know doing that they would not be able to access those federal mm-hmm. standards. So I think the language hasn't been written, and I think, you know, you bring up a good point, and we will discuss it further.
Thank you. Glad I brought it up.
Thank you, Representative Abel. Representative Falls.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have, a couple of questions embedded in my comments here, and I'll point them out at the end when I get done. My youngest son, when he was in high school, competed in football in the fall, took a week off, then was in hockey for a few months, then took a week off and was in baseball until they started football. And I have a hard time accepting that we need to require somebody like that to take Phi-Ed in school when he really is working out some type of physical activity 10 to 15 hours a week pretty much all year long. So that's really my first question. I would have much rather had him take a higher math class or a physics class or something like that instead of Phi-Ed, which our school required him to take. Since then, though, he's now going to a school where his intramural baseball or volleyball team won the championship, his intramural football team won the championship, and his intramural soccer team won the championship. So, you know, he's using all of those skills, although it's not earning him any money, but he is using those skills. But for myself, the only thing that I do for physical activity is play basketball. And that's because when I was in high school, I played basketball and did pretty well with it. And so I still do that now a couple times a week. I get up at 6 o'clock and play with a group of people. But my concern is that where my nephews go to school, one of them is in 7th grade. He's 6 feet tall. And by the time he's maybe even a freshman, will probably not be playing basketball anymore because there are 2,000 kids or however many kids in his school, and his odds of making the team are not that good. And we didn't address that here, yet it's probably where more students get their activity than in Phi-Ed is in the extracurricular activities, at least through 8th grade. Isn't there some way that we can increase the number of students in extracurricular activities, hockey, basketball, football, volleyball, all of those things, throughout their high school years? In 7th, 8th grade, in the school I'm most familiar with, we may have 20 or 30 kids per grade out for a sport. By the time they're in 9th to 10th grade, it's down to 4 or 5. Can't we do something to
that? Senator Bada.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and Representative Faust. I agree with you completely, and we wrestled with this on our subcommittee because we in the Senate, led by Senator Saltzman, tried to have an amendment to the bill that went through saying that if you were in sports, that you actually got a waiver about your Phi-Ed credit because, you know, I have sons who are three-sport athletes as well, and I needed them during the school day to be taking their math and science. They did enough with their physical activity. And so we haven't let that go. The problem was where we got hung up is whether or not you can embed the need to have physical education standards in the extracurricular, which I personally don't support. I think we ought to let the extracurricular activities be what they are and that should go for the 60 minutes a day. And that we want to encourage that. And again, when I mentioned incentives to these school districts to get every kid active, that would work. So I have not given up on that, and I'm going to be working with Senator Saltzman to figure out how to draft legislation that rewards kids for their participation and allows them perhaps to waive out of other things. And I know Representative Detmer felt pretty strong about this issue.
Mr. Chair. And again, many schools, when they hire coaches, many of them are not certified in physical education. And many of them are outside the schools. And I know that in the courses over the years that I taught, we studied human physiology of exercise, and all the components that goes into building a fitness program. And that isn't necessarily the role of a coach. I coach too. But I really feel we need to keep physical education separate from the extracurricular activities outside the school when it comes to education. In terms of the 60 minutes, yes, we get a lot of students that are in three sports and get their exercise. But the education part of it, that's a very important part of it for lifelong learning.
Professor Deborah, I was very struck by the concept or the the proposal that we should be teaching one another how to develop our own fitness programs. And I'm sure many of us here probably all have friends who were great jocks back in the day, and they don't look so good nowadays. And they, and, you know, they probably could hit a jumper, but 20 years later, you know, didn't translate that into a good daily personal fitness programs for themselves. And I think that's part of what you're getting at.
Mr. Chair, you know, looking back at the staff that I taught with and the strength training course that I also taught, students had to develop their own fitness program, and we spent a day in the classroom besides what we did in the weight room and going through the different lifts. So it's part of the education process.
I do have two other questions, Representative Norton. I'd love to get them in so we can keep them.
Yeah, I'm going to make two quick points if I could on this. One, as Representative Faust mentioned, we have actually taken out the high school requirement portion of it, so we did not spend a lot of time discussing this topic because we felt it was a mandate. And as you can see, there's disagreement among the three of us at the table on this particular issue. So that has been taken off the table. So I just wanted to mention that. You raise a wonderful point. I think it deserves further discussion. We didn't have it this summer. The other one is the issue that you brought up that I think is worthy of future conversation, and I won't get into it now, but that's the large schools. When you have a single team, when you've got 2,000 students or 3,000 students in a school, the same number of kids get to participate at that school as does at a very small school where, you know, half your class can be participating. So I think we have some issues to discuss regarding that and it really becomes a local issue, but I think it does raise the level of importance for other extracurriculars outside of varsity athletics, and I think that's something that we might discuss in the future.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to say to Representative Detmer, first of all, I can't see you now, but maybe move this way, thank you. first of all, I didn't realize that you had all that background, and it's really wonderful, especially the part about working with your military experience, working with adults and so on. And I was interested in the litany of things that you listed, the effects of having increased exercise and so on, increase in performance, decrease in disruptive behavior, promoting learning and concentration, especially being less depressed. Mm-hmm. And so we all know that this is a very unhealthy job that we all have. So I'm wondering if you could design a program for legislators and staff who do sit on our behinds much of the day and need to have a little better performance and a little less depression.
Mr. Chair, I was very surprised coming into a facility like this. You know, my office was in a boys' locker room for 34 years, but to come into a facility like this and work, that we don't have a facility here that we, when we do get time as legislators to get in and get a workout in, aerobic workout and so forth. So that would be something in the future that I would like to see happen here at the state capitol, that we have a place as legislators and staff to be able to work out when we have the free time to do that.
And Mr. Chair, I had that same concern when I came here, and if you'll remember, I handed out pedometers to all the legislators, and we have marked off the miles and the walking in the tunnel downstairs just for this very reason, because it's the only place we have to exercise. So.
Representative Norton, I may have my first hearing as a walking hearing. We'll,
there you go.
We'll loop and we'll walk around.
I won't wear high heels that day.
I'll give you a heads up. I don't see Representative Dietrich here. She had the last question. And so maybe I'll buy a little bit of time, and Representative Norton and Detmer perhaps just closes out with some closing thoughts or announcements or anything that you wish to share at this point.
Well, I think I made those earlier, just that it really was a pleasure to work bipartisanly and in a bicameral way as well. We don't have enough joint hearings where we can all come together and agree, and that also my extreme pleasure in having so many of the department staff there to help us come up with recommendations that I think won't be resisted this year, that we can all come together on and at least move in the right direction to help address childhood obesity, ultimately adult obesity, because we know there's a direct link there, and improve health and lower health care costs.
Representative Norton and Representative Detmer, it's been my experience here over many years. I won't share right away what they are. That persistence is a important thing to possess as a legislator, and oftentimes it takes many sessions before a seed really takes root and develops into good policy. And so I really appreciate both of your persistence, and also not just coming back, but coming back in ways in which many other folks are being empowered with information. New information is being put forward on the table. New creative thoughts are being developed. I suspect we'll have a very healthy and hopefully very good set of recommendations translated into law by the end of this session. So, Representative Dietrich, I was just calling your name. We have a few seconds if you want to get in your question.
I am very sorry about that, Mr. Chairman, but, you know, when we see each other, you have 100 questions.
Yes,
just that for the task at hand. Yes, I have a question. It is on the federal funds that keep getting referred to. If we do have a statewide standard for FIAD, are those federal funds guaranteed? And then what kind of strings attached to those federal to the federal funding?
They're called PEP grants, Mr. Chair and Representative. And I don't think there's any ever a guarantee, although I do believe we're the only state that didn't have schools getting grants this last year, if I have that correctly, and somebody can correct me if I'm wrong. So I do think there would be every likelihood that we would be bringing millions of dollars into this state. But again, they're competitive grants and they're handed out. They do, at the federal level, try to hand grants out in a fair fashion. So I think you would see some schools get them. But this component just needs to be in there in order for that to be successful.
Follow-up.
Representative.
Yeah, and then another question is, in regards to your recommendations under physical activity, the bullet number 2, I've already asked questions about this, but I would just like to reiterate that I think 60 minutes daily in the school environment, I asked if that meant the school day, and the answer to my question was yes, that at this point it does mean the school day. And I think that really limits you. There are so many activities that can be more innovative type activities that can be developed to really transform the look, sound, feel of healthy kids, healthy environments. And so much of that can happen outside the school day. And in fact, sometimes I think kids bring a better attitude towards it. When you're outside the school day, you're with like groups, you're with like skill levels, and that brings a feeling of teamwork and friendship and all the things that are also very healthy that in life. That I just think, and I'll just keep reiterating that, I think that just having it in the school day really puts up some roadblocks to, and it's almost like just trying to take the old existing program and have it look new, as opposed to really opening up the horizons of how could we really become a healthy society. If you required that I become healthy while I'm here, the 6 hours that I'm here, that's very difficult. But if you can include when I go home, it just opens up a whole new avenue.
Quickly, Representative.
Yes, and I absolutely agree, and I wish you had been there on the day we had this discussion, because we talked about exactly what you're talking about, using the physical education teacher not only as part of the classroom hours that a student gets, but using that professional in a way that they can help other teachers, including the aides and teachers that are at recess, and recess is counted toward that 60 minutes. The active recess concept, the time at lunch the children have, you know, they go in the cafeteria, they eat in 10 minutes, and then they want to go play for the next 30, those minutes count as well. We just need to make certain that it's quality time doing physical activity and not sitting along a fence doing nothing. And so I think you would have liked the discussion, and I don't think we're in terrible disagreement. I think data shows that too many kids don't do what you do as a parent or I might do as a parent. Not all children have access to outside activities, that they're spending way too many hours sitting in front of a computer and a television and don't get that. I do believe there's certainly a contingent of students that do have lots of outside activity, not enough. So I think it's up for discussion, and I appreciate your input on it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Dietrich. And once again, Representative Norton, Representative Detmer, thank you for your work in arranging for this testimony. I want to thank everyone in the room here, our testifiers, as well as folks in the general public who placed a high priority on this policy issue. Mm-hmm. I look forward to an engaging legislative session on this. On behalf of Representative Thiessen, Chair of the Health Care and Human Service Policy and Oversight Committee, and on behalf of our K-12 Education Policy Committee, I call this meeting adjourned.
Thank you.